This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, find out what language is really hiding under its mattress. Today's show concerns mental health, and there's nothing particularly strong or graphic in the content, but I just wanted to let you know that the discussion nudges some topics which may not be comfortable for everybody. So if you have concerns, please sit this episode out and return in 2 weeks for the next one. Let's ready ourselves with a little light word history. Right now, it is Wimbledon. And even if, like me, you don't care about tennis, this is exciting because of etymology! Albeit somewhat contested etymology, as can be found for the word tennis, which turned up around the 14th century and most likely came from the Old French tenir, meaning to hold, or more precisely, the Anglo-French imperative form of the verb tenets, meaning hold or receive or take, which servers used to shout at their opponents. At the time, the game was called La Palme, because it was played by hitting the ball with the palm of the hand, but it's understandable that if spectators observed players shouting tenets all the time, they might assume tenets was the name of the activity. But if that's true, surely by now tennis would be known as... It took a while for tennis to become the racket sport we're familiar with now, which is widely attributed to Major Walter C. Wingfield, who first demonstrated it in 1873. It wasn't called tennis at the time. He named it after the ancient Greek for ball skills, spheristike. Apologies if I didn't pronounce that correctly, but in my defence, nobody else used to pronounce it correctly either. Not being ancient Greeks, they'd pronounce it spheristike, or even sticky, so the game was soon rebranded lawn tennis. To distinguish this newfangled tennis, devotees of old hand-based walled court tennis called that real tennis. They just want everyone to know they liked tennis before it was cool, yeah? Alright, on with the show. Words hold a lot of power. I don't mean kitten or buttercup or syllabub should have you cowering, but thanks to your own brain, words have the capacity to become your worst enemy.
It could just be a random word. So it could be something that's attached to something that you know of, or it could be something that you happen to think at the time you were feeling awful and therefore that became the word that means something.
No words are safe.
No, because that part of our mind just mashes things together in different ways, and if it mashes two things together at a time when you're feeling a certain way, that connection sticks, which is where the therapy comes in, which is unsticking those two things.
That's Dr. Jane Gregory. She's a clinical psychologist who specialises in cognitive behavioural therapy, or CBT.
Traditionally in CBT, the idea was to take those thoughts and then try and challenge them in some way. And if you look at them more rationally, then you feel differently. But often people just get stuck on those thoughts because you can't stop them popping into your mind. And that part of the brain learns from experience rather than from logic or information. So if you've had an experience of telling someone your whole life that you're not good enough or that you have to do things perfectly to be acceptable, then that's what will always feel true. Well, that's the story that you'll continue telling yourself. And you can't stop that thought from popping into your mind, but you can choose whether or not you respond to it.
So how do you do that? How do you make the words tormenting your brain behave themselves?
It's basically stripping it of any meaning at all, reducing it back down to a series of letters or as a string of words that don't actually have to mean anything. You know, if you have a random thought that pops into your mind that doesn't mean anything to you, like the sky's orange, you don't latch onto that and think, what's wrong with me that I had that thought, or the sky must be orange because I had the thought that it's orange. But if you have the thought that I'm a failure or whatever, if that thought pops into your mind, for some reason you pay attention to that as if that's true. So the idea of the type of therapy that I do is about just taking away any meaning that the words have.
What if you need those words for other things in your life, but you've stripped them of meaning?
So it's not removing the words entirely from... from your mind.
It's not going cold turkey.
Yeah. The technique is called cognitive diffusion, and so defusion as opposed to diffusion. And the idea being that if you are emotionally fused with a thought, then you will have an emotional response to that thought, that you're taking that thought as true or having some kind of power. And so to defuse that thought, you take away the meaning of that particular thought. And the way that I do that in sessions is to, first of all, to identify what the thought or the word is, and then to work out whether it's heard in their head or seen in their head, so whether they can see the letters or whether they can hear the word, and then choosing a technique that fits with the way that they experience it in their head. There might be a trigger word where somebody sees a word that means something to them, so like the word hate. They can't read a newspaper because if that word appears in an article, then the letters will trigger off that feeling.
That's quite inconvenient.
Yes, it is. And that's sometimes the point where people come for therapy, is when it's getting in the way of living their life.
Jane uses various different techniques to help patients remove the meaning of words.
I've done examples with people who see the words in their head as letters rather than hear the words, where they picture the word and then picture rhyming words and stack them on top of each other, and then sort of in the way of the Pixar lamp taking place of the eye, that they get the rhyming words to bounce up and down on top of the trigger word and squish it down until it's really, really small, and then the rhyming words are normal size and the trigger word is reduced to tiny, tiny letters.
Which I suppose is easy in words like hate, because there are a lot of rhymes for hate, but failure is much more difficult
to
rhyme with.
For those ones, maybe not so helpful. But you could do the same thing with just visualising the words and using imagery to shrink them down to an unreadable size, or picturing yourself next to the word, and with every in-breath you grow a little bit, and with every out-breath the word shrinks a little bit, so you're growing and the word is shrinking, and just seeing yourself next to the word strengthening, and as you get stronger the word itself gets smaller and weaker. Or blow them up like a balloon. Even just shifting them around in your head can help to detach the meaning from it, because then it just becomes some words that you play around with in your head rather than something that has meaning, that needs to be, the meaning needs to be responded to, rather than just a series of letters or words.
As well as making the words silly or manageably puny, you can change their context.
So sometimes it's just changing how the story plays through your mind. Anything that detaches you a little bit from the thought. So rather than letting it just be I'm a failure, it's I'm having the thought that I am a failure. So it's already just adding an extra level there between you and the thought. Or reminding yourself that that's a story that you tell yourself is true, even though it may or may not be true. So it's anything that you can do to detach from the thought and strip it of the meaning. So sometimes it's just reminding yourself that it is just a thought. It might be singing it in your head rather than thinking it,
because that makes it sound more cheerful. I'm a failure.
Well, it just makes it sound less real. So it could be just singing it like that, or singing it to a tune that you know, and or just repeating it over and over again until it loses its meaning.
That doesn't reinforce it, does it, the repetition?
I think it depends on the way that you repeat it. So if you're just in there going, I'm a failure, I'm a failure, I'm a failure.
Writing it all over the walls.
Yeah. But if you're saying, I'm a failure, I'm a failure, I'm a failure, I'm a failure, then it just makes it become a series of words or a series of letters rather than a sentence that means something to you.
So not like a positive mantra where you repeat to yourself, I'm amazing, I can do it. You repeat the thing that is destroying you.
And actually, in the same way that those positive mantras often aren't that effective.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can't make thoughts have meaning, though you can't create the story without experiencing it to be true. So those things sort of make you feel good for a little while, but actually it's your experiences that you learn from rather than the words.
Are our brains just not that easily tricked by mantras and stuff?
Well, our brains are just more attuned to negative. We're meant to look out for danger. We're meant to protect ourselves.
Then.
Yeah, it is incredibly practical. A high proportion of the thoughts that go through our mind do have a negative connotation to them. And you don't have to respond to all of them. It's like our brain's way of just checking that everything's okay. Sometimes it's worth listening to it. Sometimes those thoughts are incredibly helpful and do force you to look out for things going wrong or to protect yourself. And other times it's just our mind testing things out, just throwing ideas out there, and we don't have to respond to all of them. You also don't want to strip words of their meaning completely. And so if there are words that make you feel uncomfortable, and it's because there's something uncomfortable about that word, you don't have to change everything that makes you feel uncomfortable. So paedophilia is a good example that that's something that a lot of people just hearing the word makes them feel a little bit uncomfortable. And I don't think that's such a terrible thing that you feel bad when you hear that word.
Yeah,
and
that's not a random association.
That's not a random association.
Some of Jane's patients don't speak much English, so she works with them through an interpreter, and she says this can actually be quite helpful sometimes, as the patient is already at a remove from the words. But what if a patient doesn't have the vocabulary to convey their emotions at all?
That's an interesting question, because that's actually one of the things that I've noticed is a huge hurdle to therapy, is people who have grown up in an environment where they weren't given the vocabulary for their emotions. And so they just experience everything as a general distress, or I'm upset, or I'm often angry. So not really being able to distinguish between emotions. And so for people like that, actually, it's almost the opposite of what we were talking about before, where you're stripping the word of its meaning. This is actually providing the language to describe the feeling. So I have some patients that I see where for the first couple of weeks, all we're focusing on is finding words to describe the feelings. And I've literally just got a sheet of emotion words. There's, you know, maybe 100 different emotions on there, and people just look at them until they find a word or several words that describe what they're feeling when they're feeling it. And I think that that is a huge thing to be given as a child, to be able to have the vocabulary to describe how you feel. It's one of the simplest ways to validate how you feel. And feelings are something like thoughts that you can't stop them from arising. And so if something is happening that you have no control over, and you also don't have a word for, and no one around you is telling you that it's okay, then you're suffering with that in private. Whereas if you have a word to describe it, then at the very least you know what's happening and you're validating what's happening. Ideally the people around you would be doing that as well, but that doesn't always happen, and that then becomes my job as a therapist to say that it's okay to feel what you feel.
As well as treating patients, Jane Gregory writes a really interesting occasional blog about CBT, which you can read at cognitivebehaveyourself.com. Before I go, your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is virga, plural virgi, meteorology. A mass of streaks of rain appearing to hang under a cloud and evaporating before reaching the ground. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick. You can extend the hand of online friendship at Twitter and Facebook / allusionistshow, and pay the show a visit at home at theallusionist.org.